This meeting in the Crime Victims Criminal Records Division will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. We need a motion for the minutes of February 26, 2010.
So moved.
And Representative Hillstrom moves the minutes. I assume they've been all thoroughly reviewed by everyone. All in favor of the minutes from February 26, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Minutes are approved. I don't need any no's on that, by the way. And first bill on the agenda is House File 3312. We have a chair moves House File 3312 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Representative Greiling, are you ready to proceed?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am ready to proceed, members. I have been in the legislature for 18 years. I have never, to my recollection, or I guess I was when Representative Spoglin was the chair. I was here once with the bill, but I pretty much managed to stay out of this committee. I've never been before this committee, hence the cookies. I've also never carried a bill that had anything to do with dogs. So here I am today with a bill in your committee that has to do with dogs. I hope you'll be kind, but I think it's a bill that hopefully you will look kindly on, and it's service dogs for people who are blind, and it is a bill that we might not think was necessary until you hear the story of the woman who's going to be before us today. It's a bill that proposes providing a criminal penalty for intentionally rendering a service animal unable to perform its duties, requiring that offenders who are convicted of harming service animals pay restitution, and then clarify that civil penalties are not precluded because of other penalties. And that's basically what the bill does. And for the testimony, and I know you've got a big bill coming, so we'll try to be concise. I have with me Lolly Legewski, and she will be the one telling the story, the reason for the bill, and then my constituent, Chris Bell, who's the board chair of the Advocacy and Legislative Committee for the American Council of the Blind. The bill is supported by the Minnesota Guide Dog Users, and the National Federation of the Blind has not yet taken formal action, but they're aware of the bill. They look very favorably on it and are very supportive, but they haven't yet, with their timeline, taken formal action. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to have Lolly Legewski give her testimony.
Thank you, Representative Greiling. Ms. Legewski, would you please clarify your name, please, for the record as well?
Certainly.
Thank you.
My name is Lolly Legewski from Minneapolis, and thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for hearing us today. In September of 2009, I was preparing to do some shopping. I walked into the Target store in downtown Minneapolis, and in the foyer, I felt my dog's legs buckle. I didn't know what had happened, but she faltered, and I reached down to check her out. She seemed to be okay, and she righted herself. The woman to my left said, someone just kicked your dog. And it took me a few seconds to absorb that statement, because I never would have expected something like that to happen. I asked her to repeat it. She did. And she offered to go get someone from security. Once we connected with security, they were able to find on the store video the individual who had done it, and they saw the incident. And what actually happened was, it was a woman who kicked my dog Brooke, who is a black lab seeing eye dog, in the jaw. And I will say that the one question that has come from everyone, without exception, is who would do such a thing? Well, I think that these things happen maybe more than you realize. And in my situation, all of the pieces came together in a way that helped us bring this here today. There was a witness, usually there isn't, and she came forward and was willing to testify. There was video, usually there isn't, and the store security and the Minneapolis police took the incident seriously, and they actually got the woman. She hadn't left the area, she was just outside the store. They brought her in, they charged her with animal cruelty, and we proceeded to prosecute the case in the court system. These dogs are, in a sense, our lifeline. They get us around every day. They are supremely trained, and actually I should say educated, because what happens with guide dogs and service dogs in general, but guide dogs in particular, is the amount of work and training that goes in, it's education from veterinarians, geneticists, instructors who train the dogs, and the actual handlers, these dogs have a lifetime bank of experience, good experience with human beings, but one incident can change that. It can change it if the dog is injured physically, and it can change it if the dog is injured psychologically. I determined quickly that my dog was not physically injured, but I was concerned about a psychological injury to her, which could have caused either her to need to be retrained or me to have to replace her. Currently, the value of a dog that has this kind of breeding and training is around $50,000. So it was quite an incident, something I never would have thought I would have had to deal with. And at the same time, as I think back on my time as a guide dog handler, I've had other incidents happen, but they haven't been in the same circumstances. As I said, there weren't witnesses, there wasn't video, and I probably wouldn't have been taken seriously. What this did is it brought all of these factors together to make us to enable us to put some legislation together today that we hope will strengthen the penalty if someone should intentionally injure, whether it be physically or psychologically, the dog that guides us through our day. I also have stories from a coworker who has a service dog, currently a retired service dog, but twice in his work life, they were approached by individuals who wanted to pet the dog, and when my coworker said, "No, this is a working dog, and I can't let you do that because it would distract him from his job, which could jeopardize my safety," the individuals in both cases rammed a stroller with a child in it into the dog forcefully. So I think these situations, we never think that they might happen, but in fact they do. And I never thought that I would have to protect my dog from someone else who might want to harm it. But in fact, I do, and that's the reason I'm here today.
Thank you, Ms. Lieske. Are there any questions from members of the committee for Ms. Lieske? I do have a question, Ms. Lieske. Do you know the statute under which you were able to successfully prosecute this individual at the Target in September?
Actually, I'm going to defer to Chris for that.
Sure. Mr. Bell?
Yes. It's the current law, which we are amending or seeking to amend today by HF 3312. That is to say, it's Section 343.21, Subdivision 8A. However, as Lolly can explain, the prosecution ultimately wasn't successful because of the status of her attacker, who was found to be obviously mentally ill, and otherwise the case was put on hold, and she was referred to the mental health court, and I believe sent to a facility.
Yes.
So. Currently, there was not a completed prosecution, but it was under the statute at issue today.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. And did you have further testimony as well, Mr. Bell?
Yes. Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. I just want to emphasize the three main points. First, that what we are doing is strengthening a law that is currently on the books, Chapter 343, Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and then Subdivision 343.21 and Subdivision 8A relating to service animals. As it's currently written, for violators to be prosecuted, the prosecution and the penalty depends upon the degree to which a service animal suffers bodily harm. It does not take into account the possibility that the result of an intentional assault may be to render the dog unable to do its duties, even if there's no bodily harm. And that's the key addition that we are proposing to make in the law for the reasons that Ms. Liuski stated. Secondly, in current law, the only penalties relate to maximum terms of imprisonment and a maximum fine, or both. We desired, and this bill adds as a mandatory penalty, the right of restitution. And this allows people like Ms. Liuski and others whose dog has been rendered unable to do its duties to recover from the wrongdoer costs related to that crime. It is a fair provision because it takes into account if someone is indigent and cannot pay, there's can be a period of payments, or the amount of money to be paid can be reduced. This restitution provision comes directly from another current statute relating to protection of service animals that's in the criminal code, namely section 609.226, which refers to criminalizing when a dog owner is intentionally or negligently lets his or her dog loose and attacks the service dog. In that statute, only restitution is available, and that restitution provision is exactly the provision that we are proposing in this bill to make them parallel. And lastly, this bill clarifies that notwithstanding the criminal prosecution under subdivision 8A, the victim may assert any civil remedies that might be available for the violation of Section 8A. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. Are there any questions of members of the committee for Mr. Bell? Yes, Representative Coles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bell, I was frantically trying to find the statute regarding restitution for harm caused by dogs to service animals, because I was the chief author of that legislation back in, I believe, 2004 or 2005. And I guess, Representative Greiling, I would strongly encourage you, if this bill makes another stop, to have, I had the privilege of having a beautiful German Shepherd sitting next to me on the floor at the witness table as we presented my bill back then, and it was great to carry the bill. I need to think a little bit about whether the gross misdemeanor is the right level or not. I'm supportive of the bill and what you're trying to do. And I just want to, I was trying to find this because I thought we had done something like this. I knew I had done something like this. I remember sitting in the governor's reception room for the bill signing ceremony. I think this is a good bill. I'm glad you're bringing it forward. But next time you should have a service dog sitting next to you. It's even tougher for members to vote against a bill like this when there's a beautiful... oh, there is. I didn't even see your dog there, Ms. Lipsky. It was hiding behind the garbage can. I didn't see your dog.
Representative Greiling.
Yeah.
Representative Greiling. They're service animals, so they're quiet. They're eating it.
Thank you. Representative Shemansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not a question for the testifiers, but more of a general question in the definition of a service animal. And I appreciate the testimony that we've heard this morning, especially for the visually impaired. But my question on service animals was this: would this also include law enforcement, canine units, for example, or search and rescue animals, or security and guard dogs? What's the scope that we could anticipate in coverage of this bill?
I don't know who that's a question for, Representative Shemansky, but I did pull out Chapter 609 to look that up, actually, about 5 minutes ago and didn't find it, but...
Okay, would you just want to address that?
Ms. Perius can address that, Representative Shemansky.
Mr. Chair and members, the definition of a service animal is an animal trained to assist a person with a disability.
Ms. Perius, you had stated that the also the definition of law enforcement animal was under that chapter as well? Okay. Well, does that answer your question, Representative Shemansky?
Yes, it does, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Thank you. Any further questions of members of the committee or the testifiers? Hearing none, then I want to congratulate your testifiers on their testimony, Representative Greiling. It was well done, poignant to the point, and especially to address something that occurred to your dog, Ms. Lieski, last September. So with that, the chair renews his motion that House File 3312 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor of said motion, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you. Representative Paymar, are you prepared to proceed on House File 2960? Members, we are going to wait for Representative Mullery, who is not here. He is going to be doing his two bills at the end of this hearing. And I would remind people in the room that we have a lot of testifiers who would like to testify on this bill. So please keep your testimony to a minimum. Get to the point quickly. The only other thing I would add is I would add my favorite NRA slogan, which is an armed society is a polite society. So be polite when you're testifying.
Just your name is fine. That's very good.
I would also add, before Representative Paymar begins, we have on the list seven proponents. There is was understanding that there would be 5 minutes testimony per person. I think someone said that. I never said that, but that's not going to happen because that's 35 minutes into it, plus the additionals. We still need to hear from opponents as well. So for those of you who are preparing your testimony, limit it to 2 minutes at the most, so begin paring it down now. Representative Paymar would move his bill 2960. Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I would like to move House File 2960, and after the testimony, I would ask that we lay over House File 2960 for possible inclusion in the committee division report. Mr. Chair, I hope that my testifiers, I was told that we had you had a 90-minute hearing here, and that I think they were preparing for a little bit longer talks, but we'll try to, if we could try to limit it to 2 or 3 minutes. I that's what we heard yesterday, so I'm...
We'll do our best to be flexible, Representative Paymar.
How about if I limit my talk to be real brief and give them my time?
That'd be perfect, Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this bill helps keep dangerous weapons out of the hands of dangerous people by closing the current gun show loophole. The loophole that presently exists allows anyone to buy any kind of firearm and any number of firearms at a gun show without undergoing a background check. The dangerous people the background check can uncover are felons, individuals who have been convicted of a domestic assault, and those with serious mental health problems. This provision is supported by the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, and it has the support of 82% of Minnesotans. This bill, unlike the bill that was authored last year, only deals with gun shows. It does essentially three things. It requires gun show promoters to arrange for the services of one or more licensed firearm dealers on the premises of the gun show to obtain background checks. If a person at a gun show wants to transfer a firearm, they must use the background check services from a federally licensed firearm dealer to conduct that background check. And it requires the gun show promoter to post a sign stating the requirements for background checks. The ATV has identified gun shows as a major trafficking channel in the illegal gun market. It is obvious why. Unlicensed sellers at these shows provide a limitless supply of guns with no background check. In one 17-month period alone, the AFT reported that 25,000 guns were trafficked through gun shows. Now, the opponents of this bill will say that this infringes on Second Amendment rights. It does not. It only requires a background check. This is current law. The opponents will say that this provision violates federal law. It does not. Michigan, Pennsylvania, California, and other states use this process specified in the bill. In fact, we patterned our bill after a Colorado statute. That Colorado statute was enacted after the Columbine Massacre. Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold had a friend purchase the guns that they used to kill those students and faculty at that school from an unlicensed seller at a gun show. The opponents will also say that there isn't a problem and that gun crimes can't be traced to these purchases. Five recent videos, and we're going to show one of them, will show you a very different picture of what happens. So with that, to give my testifiers some time, I will stop talking and allow them to proceed.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. The next testifier, please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, members of the committee. As Representative Greiling said, I hope you will be kind to us today as well. I am Joan Peterson. I'm from Duluth. I'm president of the Minnesota Million Mom chapters of the Brady Campaign. I'm a member of Citizens for a Safer Minnesota Board, Protect Minnesota, and I am the national chapter elected member to the Brady Board campaign, a Brady Board of trustees. The Protect Minnesota campaign, you will see some of us with buttons, is a group of organizations and people who decided several years ago that in order for us to promote common sense gun legislation, we needed to work better together. We have a lot of people who have signed on. We have a lot of groups who support us. It's the Citizens for Safer Minnesota, Million Mom March Chapters, the Brady Campaign, Violence-Free Initiative for Violence-Free Families, and a number of other groups and organizations. It's very apt that your committee hear this testimony today and have this hearing today. Minneapolis has experienced 10 gun homicides in the first 2 months of this year, and that's just Minneapolis. That does not include greater Minnesota. On average, one person a day is shot in Minnesota, much more nationally. In fact, we hear of shootings every day. We heard of one at the Pentagon just yesterday. If you could just save one of these lives by enacting a law to protect innocent people from being shot, would you do that? The legislature is expected to protect public safety. You have passed measures for public safety. You have passed measures concerning secondhand smoke. You have passed mandatory seatbelt laws. You've passed speed limit laws. We require background checks for teachers and for coaches and for some people in certain jobs. Why then would you not require them for dangerous people who buy guns? I'm here today because my sister, Barbara Lund, was shot to death in 1992 by her estranged husband during a very difficult divorce. Her Her picture is there in front of me. It's important that we name the victims. It's important that we see pictures of the victims. They are much more than a number on a list. We thank you for hearing us today to learn how you can save lives. I fervently hope that this hearing will lead to a concerted effort to keep guns away from those who shouldn't have them. Representative Paymar has mentioned some of the ways in which dangerous people can get guns at gun shows. We have provided you with materials that dispel some of the myths surrounding the gun issue. The first myth is that there is no gun show loophole. We have a video clip that you will see for yourself. The video is of Colin Goddard. He was a survivor of the Virginia Tech shootings. This young man was shot 4 times at Virginia Tech. As a way to get involved in this issue, he became an intern for the Brady campaign and went to gun shows across the country, including in Minnesota last August. And here's the video.
Okay, there's no tax. There's no paperwork. That's worth something. That's all you can do?
No case or nothing? As is?
As is.
All right.
Give you a bag to wrap it and this is fine.
I don't think that's too bad.
Cash, of course.
That'll work.
If you're good to go with that, $225. All right. Out the door. I'm going to give you a bag to put it in.
As you can see, Colin went to gun shows all over the country. Minnesota was just one of the places he went. There are about 5 of these similar videos that show people going to gun shows to show what actually goes on at them. We know these background checks work. Since the Brady Bill was enacted in 1994, over 1.6 million prohibited purchasers have been stopped from buying guns from federally licensed dealers. But we left out of that law the private sellers. These were people who were presumed to be occasional sellers of mostly collections. But 25 years later, those private sellers walk around with assault weapons over their shoulders with a price tag on them. What is the price tag for lost lives? One of our members has started a special petition for gun owners. Here's what one gun owner said to me yesterday. We love to hunt. We just want a peaceful America. We have lots of signatures. We have enough evidence to show you that the majority of the public is with us on this issue. We have a very large email and mailing list that we activated when needed. I think you've heard from us. Many groups support us. When I talk to Minnesotans at events, I find that the public assumes that background checks are required for gun sales. When told about this so-called loophole to our law, people cannot believe it is true, and they quickly sign on to our postcards and letters. In Minnesota, a University of Minnesota survey several years ago showed that 82% of Minnesotans want background checks on all sales of guns, and that was not just gun shows, that was all sales, so we can presume that they want them at gun shows as well. I was quoted in the article yesterday in the Star Tribune as saying, it doesn't have to be this way and it shouldn't be. Ladies and gentlemen, it doesn't have to be this way. Remember, I had to read the name of my own sister on the front page of the newspaper on August 6, 1992. I am a victim. My children are victims. Her children are victims. Her friends are victims. Actually, my friends are victims. She never got to meet her grandchildren, and she never got to meet my grandchildren. Bullets changed the lives of my entire family. You can keep others from becoming victims. Please act for the victims, and please act for public safety. This is a winning issue for you. This is not a losing issue. You can make a difference, and it is your job to do so. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. Representative Paymar, your next testifier?
I believe Jared Denham is.
And if, in the interest of time, if the testifiers are presenting in order, could be down here and be ready. That would
Jared Denham, and then and next on line would be Britt. Will Swenson. So, Will, you could come down too. We could just try to move this along a little bit. We've got 3 chairs here.
Thank you, Mr. Denham. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Jerry Denham. I live in Coon Rapids, Minnesota. I'm a member of Citizens for a Safer Minnesota. And I'm here to speak in support of House File Number 2960. I am a hunter, and I am a gun owner. and gun ownership is as important to me as it is to anyone. I grew up in northern Minnesota. I shot my first deer in 1947, at a time when venison on the table was often the difference between a full belly and going hungry. I shot my most recent deer last November. Out of high school, I joined the Army and spent the better part of 2 years in Korea. Those two Novembers are the only Minnesota deer seasons I have missed. I later joined the Anoka County Sheriff's Department, serving as a criminal investigator for 30 years. So I've been around firearms some, and I know something about criminals and criminal law. I'm sure you are all familiar with the language in this bill, but let me address a couple of issues. Some say the gun show loophole is a myth. I assure you it is not. I'd like permission to uncase two firearms.
Go ahead, proceed, Mr. Denner.
These two firearms have been examined by the Capitol Security, by the way. This is a Ruger Mini 14. It's similar to the military's M16 in that it fires the same caliber cartridge. The main difference is that this weapon is a semi-automatic, not fully automatic. This is a 30-round magazine. By round, I mean bullets, so the capacity is 30 bullets in this magazine. I've had this firearm disabled, but before I did, I test fired it. I was able to fire it at the rate of 4 rounds per second. At that rate, I can easily empty this 30-round magazine in under 10 seconds. This firearm is a Springfield 9mm semi-automatic. This is a 16-round magazine. When I bought this firearm, it came with two of these 16-round magazines and one 10-round magazine. Rate of fire is about the same as the weapon that I just showed you. I didn't want to buy these firearms. I don't want them, I don't need them, but I did buy them just to make a point. I bought them at a gun show in recent years, two different gun shows actually, and I bought them without a background check. Let me repeat, no background check. I hear some people say, we have enough laws, let's enforce the laws we have. Presently, Minnesota law says that persons convicted of a felony or of domestic abuse or who are dangerously mentally ill are prohibited from possessing a firearm. Yet these same prohibited people can walk into a gun show and carry out all the firearms they can afford to buy. There's something very wrong with this picture. Now, this is not a fault of gun shows. It is a result of a gaping hole in Minnesota law. But don't ask, don't tell. As long as the unlicensed seller doesn't know the buyer's background, the seller's part of the transfer is legal. This bill, House File 2960, would close that hole, and it would do it without banning any firearm and without preventing any law-abiding person from selling one or buying one. Actually, it would help enforce the laws we already have. In the years since background checks have been required of federally licensed firearm dealers, there have been more than 1.5 million rejections of prohibited buyers. It's a no-brainer to whom these rejected buyers go next. So I ask you, please, support House File number 2960. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Denton. Mr. Swenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to speak to the committee this morning. My name is Will Swenson, and I work in the office of Mayor Michael Bloomberg in New York City. Proud to think of myself as a Minnesotan, though. My family's been here since before Minnesota was a state, and I graduated from Southwest High School in Minneapolis, so it's good to be back home today. I'm here speaking in favor of H.R. 2960. I work with the Coalition of Mayors Against Illegal Guns, which Mayor Bloomberg co-founded with Mayor Tom Menino of Boston back in 2006 with just 13 other mayors. Today, our coalition has well over 500 member mayors from around the country, and it's a diverse group. We have Democrats and DFLers, Republicans, independents, and nonpartisan mayors alike. Our 500 mayors come from big cities, suburbs, and small towns, and they've joined together for a simple reason, because they see the consequences of gun violence directly, and they want to do something about it. They often get the middle of the night phone calls and go to the hospital when a police officer in their city has been shot. And because they work closely with police, mayors are always looking for ways to help improve law enforcement. That means smart enforcement strategies, but it also takes smart laws. Let me say one thing here at the beginning about the recent Heller case. There's been some questions about its effect on the background check system. Let me just say that the Heller case did not have an effect on the United States background check system. In fact, the court's opinion specifically noted that having certain categories of prohibited individuals is in keeping with the Second Amendment, and background checks are how you determine who is in those categories. They also specifically noted that a range of other reasonable restrictions do not conflict with the individual Second Amendment right that they identified. So, trying to cover a lot of ground. So the mayors have joined together to call for common sense legislation that will respect the Second Amendment rights of individuals while helping to keep guns out of the hands of dangerous people like criminals or people with mental health issues. And that means effective background checks for gun purchases. That's why the coalition supports legislation, both in Congress and at the state level, to close the gun show loophole. It makes no sense that someone who would be denied a gun at a gun store would be allowed to simply go to a gun show instead and purchase a gun from a private seller without a background check. In New York State, like Colorado and Oregon and several other states, we have a background check requirement for gun shows. And in combination with other laws and enforcement efforts, that has helped us achieve a significant reduction in crime. In fact, FBI data show, year after year, that New York City is the safest big city in America. But mayors know that no city or state can do it alone. Many crime guns are transported across city limits and state lines. And we know the criminals who make a profit on that illegal trafficking often purchase their guns in states with weaker laws and then sell them in states where the laws are tougher. Mayors Against Illegal Guns analyzed ATF information about guns recovered in crimes across the country, and we discovered that states that have closed certain gaps in the law, like the gun show loophole, supply significantly fewer crime guns to other states. In fact, the study showed that states without background check requirements at gun shows export crime guns to other states at more than two times the rate of states that have closed the gun show loophole. If any of you like, I have some copies of that study that I could provide to them.
If we could have a page pass those around, Mr. Swenson, it would be good.
I'm sorry?
If we could have a page pass those around, the page will pass those around if you have copies.
I have them in my bag.
We'll get them after then. Thanks. Proceed, Mr. Swenson.
Illegal sales of gun shows is not just a theoretical concern. Like the video that you just saw, we also have hidden camera footage from a New York City undercover investigation of gun shows in three states, not Minnesota, but three other states, showing that many private sellers, 19 of 30, in fact, or 63% of the gun sellers that we bought guns from, were willing to sell their guns even when the prospective buyer indicated that they would not be able to pass a background check. That's against the law, and the way to fix it is to require private sellers to do their due diligence, check the background of their buyers. Like the other report, I have some copies of our investigation and some DVDs of those videos that I'd be happy to share with you. So for police who are out on the streets every day putting their lives on the line to protect the public, the consequences of the gun show loophole are easy to see. Criminals with violent records still have easy access to guns. Actually, ATF has reported that 30% of guns involved in their own illegal gun trafficking investigations had some connection to gun shows. But there are other less direct consequences that I hope you'll take seriously. Here's just one example. Last year, the Government Accountability Office examined the problem of gun trafficking from United States sources to the violent drug cartels that operate in Mexico and along the southwest border of the United States. They reported that the ATF officials they met with believe that U.S. gun shows are a significant source of the guns that are being trafficked to these violent cartels. But because the gun show loophole allows guns to be sold without a background check and without paperwork of any kind, the ATF investigators are frustrated even in their efforts to find out how big the problem is. The scary thing is that those same drug cartels have expanded their operations throughout the United States. Gangs in cities like Minneapolis and St. Paul, from coast to coast, are working with the cartels and supplying them with guns. guns and cash flow south, and drugs come back north into our communities. It's a vicious cycle, and Minnesotans lose. The solution is clear. We need background checks for sales at gun shows, just like the background checks that thousands of lawful buyers pass every day when they buy guns at licensed gun dealers. I know you have to make hard choices every day about doing the right thing, but closing the gun show loophole isn't just the right thing to do, it's also popular. We heard about one poll about the popularity here in the state of Minnesota, but a recent poll that Mayors Against Illegal Guns Commission from the Republican pollster Frank Luntz showed that 85% of Americans supported closing the gun show loophole. But the surprising thing, what you may be surprised to hear, is that NRA members actually agree. The Luntz poll found that 69% of NRA members also think the gun buyers at gun shows should have to pass background checks. I would also be happy to provide copies of the poll. I don't have them with me, but I could send them along later on. Great. So to close, I respectfully urge each of you to support HF 2960 today. But if I could, I'd like to end with a very brief personal story. My grandfather, John Dahl, had his 87th birthday 2 days ago. He's lived down in Red Wing, Minnesota for his entire life. He's been a lifelong duck hunter from a family of duck hunters. He was an Army sharpshooter in World War II and was wounded in France. And he's my personal hero. And when I first took this job, I talked to him about the work that I do and the various issues that I talk about with mayors across the country. And he stated his position on the issue quite simply, and I just thought I'd share it with you today. He said something along the lines of, if someone wants to buy a gun, that's fine. But why wouldn't you want to check their background? You have to make sure that someone's okay to buy a gun, because guns are serious business, and you don't want somebody to get hurt. I couldn't say it any better. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Swenson. Next person I have on the list for testimony is Brad Hazlett. Brad Hazlett here. Oh, there we go. Of course, yes. And after Officer Hazlett, V.J. Smith, so be ready to go. Officer Hazlett, please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning. I'm Sergeant Brad Hazlett with the St. Paul Police Department. First off, I would just like to dispel the myth that law enforcement and police officers strive for gun control or promote or recommend an unarmed society. That is absolutely to the contrary. That's not the case whatsoever. In fact, as police officers, we swore to an oath to defend and protect the Constitution, Second Amendment obviously being one of those, the right to bear arms. As law enforcement officers, we respect, appreciate, and protect the right to bear arms. I'm a sergeant and investigator assigned to the St. Paul Police Department's gang unit. I'm one of two sergeants that handles charging and prosecution for gun crimes. In other words, if there's a person arrested in the city of St. Paul that has committed a crime with a gun, I'm one of two sergeants that handles that case. On average, the St. Paul Police Department recovers 50 to 80 firearms a month, approximately two a day, from domestic assault calls, robberies, search warrants, things of that nature. We believe that that's a very reactive approach. Instead of having domestic assault victims, robbery victims, homicide victims, victims of active shooters, school shootings, things of that nature, it makes more sense to take the weapons out of the criminal's hands before it gets to that stage. One of the ways that we believe will make that easier is to close the loophole. I'm a big advocate of the right to bear arms, as most law enforcement officers are. It doesn't make sense to me personally that if I go to purchase a firearm or an ordinary law-abiding responsible citizen buys a firearm at a gun store, it's whether it be an internet purchase, it has to go through an FFL dealer, and by law there's a mandatory background check. Why would we have an opportunity at a gun show for a person to purchase a firearm without that same background check? It's not fair and it doesn't make sense to me. The St. Paul Police Department is aligned with the Minnesota Chiefs of Police and their recommendation that the House File 2960 be passed to close that loophole. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant Hazlett. Next testifier, and we are going to, if folks have questions now, and I have not seen any from members of the panel, please let me know. Vijay Smith. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Vijay Smith, the president and founder of the Minneapolis chapter of Mad Dads, which stands for Men Against Destruction, Defending Against Drugs and Social Disorder. We're crime fighters. We fight crime. We believe that gangs, guns, and violence is a serious issue in our community. And I speak on behalf of the thousands of fifth graders and fourth graders and middle school kids that in the North Minneapolis that can't go out in the playground right now because there's a gang war going on. I speak on behalf of the mothers and fathers in our community that want to see violence come to an end. I speak on behalf of my little granddaughter that was at the door to greet me at 5:42 yesterday evening when I was in the middle of gun battle myself in South Minneapolis, where two gang members were shooting each other. The bullet barely passed my head. I died between two houses, only to pick myself up, call the police, the lines were flooded, and to let them know that there had been a shooting right in front of me. My grandbaby didn't understand that. She wanted to still see Papa give her a hug and a kiss, as I told my wife what happened. I know that we have a serious issue. I turned my life around. I used to be a part of organized crime, and I turned my life around because I knew God wanted something better for me. And when I turned my life around, I realized, well, we used to get our guns from drug dealers that buy their guns from gun shows, and they would sell them to the gang members, and those guns are being used out on the streets today. I think it's important that we do something about this because, see, we at some point in our lives, we have to put profit behind people and put people first. I decided to change my life to put people first, and I think it's important that we look at this and change this so we can protect the lives of the children in our communities, the families in our communities. I know when I go home, I can't move from the neighborhood I live in, but I can surely fight against those things that hurt my neighbors and myself. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Next testifier is Brent Gertek.
We have Brent Gertek.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm from Duluth, Minnesota, French River, and I'm a gun owner and a hunter. I make Kentucky rifles for a living, and so I'm certainly not against gun rights or gun ownership. But I've come to realize that there's a serious loophole in this country the way gun laws are written. And sometimes it's called the gun show loophole. It's really bigger than that. The gun show loophole is part of the bigger loophole. But it's something we have to close. And the best way to describe visually, to give you a picture as to what the problem is here I am at this desk. Let's say this is a gun show. There you are at another desk. I'm selling guns. You're selling guns. You're a dealer, federally licensed dealer. You sell a gun to someone, you have to do a background check. I don't. All right? You could have the same weapons, same type, quantity, everything that I have. And they can come to me and walk out the door, and I'm not required to really ask them anything about their history. Now, the system is basically set up so that, well, it's been described to me this way. This is a pretty good analogy. You go to an airport. You're going to take a flight somewhere. And you go to security, and you take your bags, and it runs through the radar machine, and then you got to take your shoes off, and you got to walk through that door frame thing, and they run the wand over you and all this stuff. You know, then you're pulling things out of your pockets, and next thing you know, they got you in your underwear and everything. But then, alongside this security line is another line, and people are just going through. They're not being checked, the luggage isn't being looked at, nothing. Now, I wouldn't want to fly out of an airport like that, but that's exactly the way gun shows operate now. And like Jerry said, it's not the fault of the gun shows, it's the way the laws are written. These laws will not stop gun shows. The other states that have passed these laws, the gun shows do fine. Personally, I think it's an advantage. Because I do exhibit at some gun shows, I don't want to be seen as the cause of a violence issue in the cities. And I personally think the background check law protects gun shows by taking the heat off of them. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Gertek. The last testifier we have on the list is Donna Evans.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Donna Evans. I'm a survivor of gun violence in a domestic incident years ago with my husband, so I'm blessed to be here today. Yet at the same time, I lost a nephew in 2008 while I was lobbying over here for this bill. He was involved in a fistfight trying to protect a family member, and the young man who shot and killed him shot him in the back of the head, and it happened on the east side of St. Paul. There are people here that vividly remember that shooting. It devastated our family. It put the east side of St. Paul on the very nervous list. It wasn't gang-related. It was a dispute between two young men, one who had a criminal history and who was able to obtain a gun. And I'm asking this committee to look at this bill and send it along because it is responsible. I know that I've been a gun owner in the past, and my background was checked. And so I'm asking that this bill is moved forward so that we can protect our children, our families, so we don't have to be afraid if a dispute happens in the street that a, you know, unlicensed or unchecked gun is in the possession of someone who shouldn't have it. The young man who killed my nephew had mental issues as well as a criminal background. And I just think that this is good common sense. And I thank you for the time that you've allowed me to speak here.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Evans. I did have another addition to the list who was, I don't have down as proponent or opponent, but Kurt Johnson with Minnesota Auctioneers. Mr. Johnson here.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Kurt Johnson with the Minnesota State Auctioneers Association. We come here neutral on this bill. I'm sent here by our membership really with a question for this committee to ask how this bill would impact the auctioneers.
Well, thank you for the question, Mr. Johnson. Do we have Ms. Perius? Can you answer that question? How would it impact auctioneers? Oh, Mr. Diebel. Mr. Diebel might have the answer to that.
Mr. Chair and members, that will require a little research and something that we'd be happy to look into.
Mr. Johnson, if you can leave your information with us at the committee, we will look into that and find out how it impacts you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Coles? Representative Paymar?
Well, I just want to, if you look at line 1.9, I talked to Mr. Johnson, I'd be happy to follow up with him later, but on, we spoke earlier on page 110 of the bill. This bill only deals with gun shows. I guess that's about as clear as we can be.
Representative Coles?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Paymar, I guess I would ask you, is it your intent to cover auctioneers under this legislation?
Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chair, no, it is not. It's only unlicensed sellers at gun shows that this bill is addressing.
And Mr. Chair, I'll save some of my other comments for later, but in light of that, if this bill is to move forward, I'll be happy to work with the auctioneers, with Chair Paymar, to make sure that that it's clear that they're not a part of this bill. I'll save the rest of my comments about whether I think the bill should move forward for later. But
thank you, Representative Coles. Mr. Denon, did you have a comment to this? Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, that's okay. I mean, I'm happy to entertain some additional language if that would assuage the concerns.
Okay. Are there any other comments or questions from members on this? Okay. Thank you very much for your testimony, your question, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you, and we look forward to working with you.
If there are members of the public who would like to come down and testify, now is the time to do that. You do need to sign in with our page right here. But I would note that if you are a member of the public who'd like to testify, please keep in mind the testimony that has already been given, and don't duplicate that as best to the best of your ability. So come on down now. Sign in. Mr. Hansen. Go ahead and have a seat. Please introduce yourself for the record, Mr. Hansen.
Thank you. Thank you to the committee for letting me speak briefly here. My name is Rome Hansen. I'm co-founder of the Ben Doren Foundation here in St. Paul. Our organization advocates for the families and friends of victims of homicide. In other words, when a homicide takes place, we're one of many organizations that are there after the police leave. Once they move on to another homicide, whether or not someone is caught, that all of that process goes on through. I'm also here today with some alarming numbers concerning health costs. Now, I received these numbers from Ruben Rosario with the Pioneer Press, and I wanted to share these with the committee, and I have the time to do so. There's a study that was conducted in 1999 from the American Medical Association, which found that $2.3 billion in total annual medical costs are associated with gunshots. $1.1 billion, or 48%, was paid by taxpayers through Medicaid, Medicare, workers' compensation, and other government programs. About 33% was paid by the wounded themselves and by other people, and about 18% was paid by private medical insurance. 2 days before Thanksgiving here in St. Paul, one of my good friends, a St. Paul cab driver named Pat Berkman, was coming home from his shift at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, walked up to his apartment building over on Fairview and University Avenue, had someone stick a .40 caliber handgun in his stomach and demand his money. Now, cabbies don't make any money. While he fumbled to get what little money he had in his pocket, it wasn't fast enough for the robber, and he pulled the trigger and shot him in the stomach with a .40 caliber illegal handgun. As we speak, my friend Pat is still up down at Regents Hospital. He went from Regents, after 7 surgeries, to Bethesda long-term medical care, where he developed another infection, and they sent him back to Regents. He is now on his 10th operation, ladies and gentlemen. This happened 2 days before Thanksgiving. My friend Pat joins literally thousands and thousands of other Americans that, through no fault of their own, are victims of illegal guns. And once again, we also work with organizations called like Parents of Murdered Children. 85% of our people at Parents of Murdered Children and other organizations of such are there because they were killed with guns. I can't say it anymore. I can't put it any more bluntly. We have a pretty good gang problem, and they're fully armed. So that's what I wanted to say. I wanted to include these medical costs. Thank you for letting me address the committee today.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hansen. Please make sure you sign in. Other testifiers from the public who want to come down and be heard. And Professor Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paymar, members of the committee, my name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University. I'm, of course, not appearing here on their behalf. I'm appearing in my capacity as president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance of Minnesota. We've been sending out a number of flyers, which I assume that all members of the committee have received, so I will keep my testimony very short. There really isn't a gun show loophole. The rules for sales by private sellers are the same everywhere. They're the same whether you're selling at your house, they're the same whether you're selling at the gun club, they're the same whether you happen to be selling at a gun show. The rules are identical everywhere you go. What this bill will do is it will create a harassment situation for the 1.5 million law-abiding gun owners in Minnesota who wish to sell their private property to other folks. And one of the things that struck me in listening to all the testimony, no one testified about any links between the guns that are being misused and gun shows. The sergeant from the police department didn't testify about that. No one testified about that. You know, guns can be misused. Butcher knives can be misused. People kill and hurt each other every day in America with just about everything. And we have to deal with the people and the carnage that they cause, not the objects that they happen to be using.
Mr. Olson?
In addition, yes.
I do have a question for you about that before you go on. I heard Mr. Swenson testify about this, and I was interested in the statistics, and I'm not sure if I heard him correctly, because the emails that I've been getting from your folks or from the NRA had said that I think it was 0.4%, 0.7% of weapons used were purchased at gun shows. And my question was, well, from the testimony I've heard, maybe criminals don't get their guns from gun shows, but they do get them from criminals who the testimony has been get them from other criminals who get them at gun shows or get them at gun shows. His statistic, I believe, was 30% were linked, and I wanted to ask him about that again, to a gun show transaction somewhere. Do you dispute that? Do you say that's inaccurate?
Here's the report from the Department of Justice Bureau of Labor of Criminal Justice Statistics. Firearms used by offenders percent of inmates possessing a firearm at the time of their arrest. Source of the gun. Gun shows 0.7.
I understand that, Professor Olson, but I don't know if that answers the question I had, which is, was there a gun show somewhere in the chain of custody of that weapon?
I believe the way the question was asked, they were asking them where it had come from, so they would have been tracing up the line. I have.
Okay. Professor, Representative Olin.
Thank you, Chairman Lesh. And I don't believe the testimony that I've heard at this meeting was anything but a comment on hearsay that any gun show related to any gun case. There hasn't been any testimony, contrary to some people's beliefs, that absolutely connected those two whatsoever at this hearing.
I'm not sure I followed that. Just so I'm clear, Representative Olin, that connected which two items you're talking about?
Mr. Lesh, that connected gun shows and crimes with guns. One person indicated something went from here to here, but it was all hearsay because he wouldn't know where the gun was actually purchased because it was third hand.
Okay, thank you, Representative. Well, I think maybe we can clarify that and ask, if we could ask Mr. Swenson to clarify his statistics later, but why don't we let Professor Olson finish his testimony on this first.
I know that you're very short on time, and I have nothing further to say.
Okay. Thank you very much, Professor Olson. In that case, Representative Paymar, can Ms. Peterson clarify the statistics? She's here, or do we have Mr. Swenson?
Unfortunately, Mr. Swenson had to leave. He had an appointment with the Burnsville mayor. What he was referring to was a study that the ATF did over a 2.5-year period of time in which they traced crime guns to the original source. And what they found was that 30% of the guns that they traced came from gun shows. One could also say that all guns start out as legal purchases, and sometimes criminals don't know where their gun came from in the first place. But that is the study that Mr. Swenson was referring to.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chair, and for the witness, I haven't had an opportunity to read that study, but how far removed? I mean, if it's chased up the chain, or if it's traced up the chain to a gun show, is that two purchases removed, three purchases removed, four purchases removed?
That I cannot
answer. Ms. Peterson.
I think maybe Mr. Swenson could provide us with some more information about that. I can tell you, if I'm allowed to speak a little bit more.
Go ahead, Ms. Peterson.
There was a video that ABC News did with 2020 in which they provided money to Omar Samahi, whose sister was shot to death at the Virginia Tech shootings. He went into a gun show in Richmond, Virginia, and this is on, you probably find it on the website of the 2020 show. He went into the gun show in Richmond and bought gun after gun after gun without a background check, brought them out, put them in the trunk of his car, and there's video of the guns that were in the trunk of the car. And while he was in the parking lot, someone walked by, asked him if he had a certain type of gun. He didn't. That person would have bought it from him there. I know that sometimes the opposition does say the criminals are getting their guns from the trunks of cars. Now, I think this is pretty good evidence that shows where sometimes the guns that are in the trunks of cars come from, because there is proof from that video. So I don't have the specifics about how far removed, you know, two or three times removed. I'm not sure about that, but we can provide you with that information.
Representative Coles.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Amar, Ms. Peterson, there's nothing that this bill will do to prevent a criminal from purchasing a firearm from an individual who's not a federally licensed dealer outside of a gun show. There's nothing this bill will do to prevent that. And so Mr. Chair, I'm trying hard to hold off some of my comments, but I've heard nothing today that establishes for me that this is anything other than a solution in search of a problem. There is absolutely a problem with gun violence in America, no doubt about it. This is not going to stop gun violence in America. It's an attempt by the proponents. It's not going to stop the illegal transfer of guns, period, plain and simple. I think Ms. Peterson said, you know, if you could save one life, would you pass it? Well, there happens to be an amendment to the United States Constitution that protects the rights of individuals to bear and keep arms. There happens to be an amendment to the United States Constitution that provides us with rights to free speech and many other things. And, you know, if I could stop one person from being killed because somebody incited violence, or if I could restrict free speech just to save one person's life, would I do it? No. We have some fundamental rights in this country that were granted to us when we became a country. And this is simply an attempt, I think a misguided attempt, to stop guns, to prevent guns from being transferred. This bill, Representative Paymar's bill, House File 2960, will not stop the illegal transfer of guns. Period.
Mr. Chair, we'd like to respond to that, please.
Go ahead, Representative Paymar. Or Ms. Peterson.
It's hard for me to respond to that. I guess, having suffered the loss that I suffered, it's hard for me to hear somebody say that they wouldn't stop it if you could prevent somebody from being shot. But at any rate, we have tried a bill that would actually be more broad and prevent other unlicensed sellers from selling guns, but that did not go over very well for obvious reasons. A lot of people are private sellers and sell in their homes or whatever, and maybe that would be the solution. But my friend Brent Gertek over here has often said, he has an analogy about a swamp, and we have a big swamp here of illegal guns. They're coming in through however they're coming in, if you want to use the water analogy, the faucet or however, flowing in, and we're not draining them the way we need to. Now, we suffer no illusions that this is going to solve the problem definitively. But if we don't start somewhere, what are we saying to the public? That it's okay. It's okay for just anybody to get a gun at a gun show. I think legislators and elected leaders need to start at some point by saying this is not okay. If we stop the flow, we may be able to drain some. And as Brent and I have discussed many times, it's going to take a while to drain the swamp of the illegal guns. And you're right, this isn't going to solve the problem. But do we always say, okay, it's not going to solve the problem, so let's not start doing anything. Let's not do anything. Let's just let it continue. So that is why we're here, because we want you to start the process. As I said, we suffer no illusions that this is going to solve the problem altogether. We know it won't. But if we don't start somewhere, how can we ever stop some of this? And this is just one way to start the process.
Thank you, Ms. Peterson. I know Representative Olin has a question. I know that you may have other testifiers that want to be heard on each of the questions that members of the panel have. But I would also like, if there are any other members of the public who want to come down and testify to this, please come down now, because we're going to wrap this up very soon. And
Chair, I wonder if Mr. Denning could just respond to the representative.
Go ahead, Mr. Denning. And as you respond, I'd like to ask if anyone else, because I'm not sure if I heard it in the previous testimony, what is the statistical breakdown of if there is a similar ATF study or whatnot that states the number of guns that are sold from licensed dealers as opposed to those sold not from licensed dealers. Go ahead, Mr. Denning.
I would like to address the significance, excuse me, of gun shows. In Minnesota, annually, there are approximately 20 major public gun shows throughout the state, all the way from Duluth down to Mankato and Rochester. Most of them are in the Twin Cities and suburbs. I've been to many of these gun shows over the years, and I can testify to the fact that there are literally thousands and thousands of Minnesotans attending these gun shows. I don't want to appear to knock gun shows. I personally enjoy going to a gun show. But it is significant, the number of people, including criminals and the mentally ill, that go to these or can go to these gun shows. They're all over the state all year long. To stop the flow of firearms to these prohibited people at gun shows would be a significant improvement in our gun violence. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, very quickly, and then I know there's one person that would like to testify. I just want to, Mr. Chair, if I could, represent Coles. I just think you're wrong on this issue. And this bill is not trying to block anyone's right to purchase a weapon. I just want to make that clear. We're not trying to do that. We're just trying to say that you should have a background check. 1.6 million people who should not have possessed weapons, who failed the Brady background check, did not get weapons. That's a good thing. Keep in mind that those two kids in Columbine, they had a friend who says, quote, I would not have bought a gun for Eric or Dylan if they had to give any if I had to give any personal information or submit to a background check. She went to a gun show, and the person said, you have to submit this information. They later went to another gun show in Adams County, Colorado, where the gun show dealer was not licensed and sold them the weapons. We have a massacre. To say it doesn't happen is erroneous. Thank you,
Representative Paymar. And former Attorney General Warren Spanis is here. And I know Representative Olin had a question. Representative Olin, was your question related to Ms. Peterson's testimony or
Mr. Chairman, my comments can wait. It's not necessarily a question, but there's some false information that's been put out on a couple of things that I want to clarify.
Thank you, Representative Olin. Attorney General Spanis, it's an honor to have you before the committee. Please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Warren Spanis. I'm a retired attorney from Minneapolis. And as President Obama said the other day about health care, just about everything has been said on both sides of this argument. But at the same time, I'd just like to make a few comments. I certainly strongly support Representative Paymar's bill, primarily for the reason that it's something that I think enhances the public safety and basically makes good common sense. Make a lot of arguments about it, but basically the fact that people can buy guns and in a situation you don't know who they are or what their background is and not have a background check as required by other parts of the federal law just doesn't make any sense. And many states, I don't know how many, but many states have the same restrictions that Representative Paymar's bill has. Now, I'm fairly familiar with this subject going back to 1970s when I first ran for public office. And basically, the arguments made then were pretty much the same. Our office, Attorney General's office, introduced a bill in 1971 that basically called for stricter regulation of handgun sales. I had one author in the whole legislature. That was the police chief or assistant police chief in St. Paul, Bill McCutcheon. And I had no authors in the House, but we did get a hearing in the Senate. It was a very volatile hearing, but at the same time, I thought it was well worthwhile. We had one vote in the committee, and that was the end of that. In 1973, we tried again, and this time the late Senator Nick Coleman in St. Paul and McCutcheon were the sponsors of the bill, and we got sponsors in the House of Representatives. And eventually, in 1975, we got some restrictions on the sale of guns to people who had emotional problems or felony records. And contrary to what the arguments were against it, no one is trying to take away anyone's guns. No one took away anyone's guns. It had no effect whatsoever on hunting rights or pastime of shooting sports of any kind. And most of these arguments that you hear against this just don't make any sense. They're specious arguments that basically all we're talking about is trying to protect the public safety and keep the guns out of the hands of the people that basically don't use them wisely or use them violently. And so I just kind of have been amazed for a number of years about this whole bill. Even the National Rifle Association,
A poll was done by a very prominent Republican pollster named Frank Luntz a few months back that 69% of the members of the National Rifle Association support the bill that Representative Paymar is talking about. So obviously, what the National Rifle Association does, and I can understand, I was in elective office myself, but they try to intimidate people who make laws. And the fact is that they imply that 100% of all the hunters and sportsmen are opposed to this type of legislation. That's simply not true. Simply not true. And so I would just, again, I'm getting a little too old for this political back and forth, but at the same time, I would just hope that you, when you vote on these type of legislation, you try to protect your job, and you do your job well, is to protect the public safety. And I think this bill does protect the public safety because it basically, in some way, and not perfect, keeps guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't have them. Thank you,
Attorney General Spanos, for your testimony. We have a comment from Representative Olin, and then after that we're going to do parting remarks from Representative Paymar before we move on to Representative Mullery's bill. Representative Olin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. But before getting to my comment, I have a question for Mr. Spanos. I do understand that you had a law, and it was back in 1974, and correct me if I'm wrong, the concerns that my district has on this bill is that it infringes on private sales, because private sales are what happens at a gun can show. And isn't it true that in your bill you expressly left out private sales in 1974?
Attorney General Spanos.
Basically, I can't, Representative, recall specifically, and so I'm not able to say, but whether or not it did or not, I think private sales should be included in it, because there's no reason in the world why private sales would not protect against people who are emotionally problems or people who have felonies to purchase guns, and they shouldn't have them. So basically, whatever happened in 1974-75, I can't answer specifically, but I would guess that I was opposed to private sales being outside the law also, but I basically now take the same position that Representative Paymar takes.
Thank you, Attorney General Spanos. Did you have a follow-up?
No.
Final comments, Representative Paymar?
Mr. Chairman, I do have some public comments, and I think there are a few others sitting here that still have public comments that they want to make, and since most of the time has been addressed to the proponents, I think it's that there's an occasional person in this room that might be opposed and is entitled to at least make comments.
Representative Olin, I asked about 40 minutes ago for those who are prepared to testify to come down. I've seen people trickle down, and I've asked multiple times. So if you have comments, make those now. You've spoken several times.
Mr. Chairman, right. We've probably taken up 10 minutes of the time, and the opponents have taken up the rest, so I'm a little frustrated with the way this hearing's been handled.
Okay. Well, but
as for comments, there's a couple of things that I need to set the record straight on. As a prosecutor for 32 years, and probably best a person in this room that's probably actually handled more gun cases in court than anybody else sitting in this room would have. I'm quite sure of that, because I've handled felony levels, and I've handled every type of known to mankind, because I was a county attorney for 32 years. So I'm not coming here as anti-public safety as you would have it made out by some of the comments that have been made. That's my first objection to what the testimony has indicated. The second major point I would like to point out is, unlike Representative Paymar, I do not represent a district that shares Representative Paymar's views. If you were to take that same survey only up in District 1A, I can guarantee you the results would be overwhelmingly 82% the opposite way that statewide quote did, and I'm sure they probably maybe took a survey, one person in my district's comments, maybe. Because most of the statewide surveys I've ever seen, it hasn't happened. But before you start attacking and shaking your heads, no, I do represent a district, District 1A. I'm entitled to my comments, and I'm entitled to represent the constituents in my district without being attacked for representing them. And the comments in the newspaper, etc., that have been made seem to be wanting to attack me and my constituents because we don't agree with you. This is a democracy we operate, and I fully intend to vote against this bill because my constituents say it isn't needed.
Representative Paymar, final comments.
Mr. Chair, just thank you for your indulgence for having the hearing. Representative Olin, I totally get that this is a controversial issue, and it splits a lot of different ways in Minnesota. We have said to the NRA that we'd like to sit down with them if they had some language that they would prefer in the bill. We're just trying to plug this loophole that I think is quite glaring, and I believe our testifiers have made the point. So that's all I really wanted to say, Mr. Chair. I thank the committee, and I guess I would at this point then move that House File 2960 be laid over for possible inclusion in the division report.
Thank you, Representative Paymar. Chair lays the bill over. Representative Mullier, are you prepared to proceed on House File 3131?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coles.
Mr. Chairman, just a question, a process question, I guess. Are we going to have an omnibus bill out of this committee? I don't. Maybe we did that last year. I just don't remember. So I'm trying to figure out what. And I can promise you, Mr. Chair and members, we're going to hear from a lot of people, continue to hear from a lot of people if this issue. And that's fine. By all means, I think one of those fundamental rights that I absolutely support is the right to petition your government. So we lay this over, now what? Is it just going to sit there in the ether, or is it going to move forward? I'm just curious what the plan is.
Representative Coles, it sits there in the ether. If we move this bill out of this committee, you'll get a chance to vote on it, unless for some reason it gets recalled. Representative Coles.
And then, Mr. Chair, I guess my request of you and my request of Chair Paymar, and I'm sure that he would provide all of us with the courtesy. If that's going to happen, I think that the public deserves the right to know when that's going to happen. It should be noticed. This is a significant issue. It's a controversial issue. So it doesn't happen when, there's a couple people in the room after we've established a quorum or something like that. Let's make sure that if it's going to move forward, if there's going to be a vote, let's have a vote. That's fine. But whatever happens, then happens. But let's make sure that the public is aware and members are aware of when that vote will happen.
Absolutely, Representative Coles. There will be no trademark sneaky moves. Representative Mullery, Chair moves House File 3131 that it be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety Policy and Oversight Committee. Representative Mullery, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is probably the most controversial bill you'll see all year. It's simply Minnesota has decided to join the rest of the country. I think there's only a few states left that haven't joined the Interstate Compact on Juveniles. And what it basically does is it puts into law the compact so that we can work well when we're transferring juveniles back and forth between states. Otherwise, you have to work out a 30-page or something like that agreement each time. It regulates everything, and it also gives us a part in setting the goals for the country. We've been part of the adult one, and in several instances, Minnesota's views and things like that have actually set the precedent nationally, and we have Ms. Bish here to explain exactly in detail.
Ms. Bish, please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Roseanne Bish. I'm the Deputy Compact Administrator for the Minnesota Department of Corrections. With this bill you have before you, would allow Minnesota to become a member of the new Interstate Commission. We've been, the current compact was passed in Minnesota back in 1957. And most, as Representative Mullery has indicated, most of the states, I think it's we're at 41 now, have moved to this new compact. And what this bill will do, it's a framework for the compact. It establishes a national commission, of which each state will have one representative. That's where they vote and pass rules. It establishes a state council for each state. It has an automated tracking system, and it outlines the duties and responsibilities of all the member states. We have for you an article that was written by the director of the new Interstate Compact. It talks a little bit about what the Juvenile Compact is about. It's designed to move juveniles who are on supervision, non-treatment juveniles who are on supervision between states so that they still have supervision. And it provides for the return, the safe return of runaways, escapees, and absconders. On the back of this article, we have a map of the states that have passed and not passed. Thank you. As Representative Mulry had indicated on our adult compact, there's actually rules that have been passed with the language that's been proposed by the Minnesota State Council. That State Council has been a great benefit, and this juvenile compact will be very similar to the adult compact. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Bish. Any other questions for members of the committee for Ms. Bish or for the bill's author? Representative Mulry, any further comments on this?
No, Mr. Chairman. I think it's self-explanatory that it's greatly in our benefit to do part of this.
And the chair renews his motion that House File 3131 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor of motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. To your next bill, chair again moves House File 3381 that it be recommended pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. Representative Mulry, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm on the Information Task Force, and they represent all sides of the juvenile data, and it isn't easy that they come when they come up with an agreed upon language. And this year they came up with one point and that everybody could agree on. And that's this bill, just to extend the juvenile history on the arrest from 6 months to 1 year. Ms. Katie Engler will explain it.
Go ahead, Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, Katie Engler, currently on assignment at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. As Representative Mulry indicated, this is an initiative from the Criminal and Juvenile Justice Information Policy Group and Task Force. They've been looking at a number of issues related to juvenile records. Right now, if prosecutors and law enforcement are not able to act within the 6 months currently in the statute, the arrest record goes away at the Bureau, and then when the disposition for a particular case arrives, we don't have the pieces to meld together. And so what the proposal is that's before you is to lengthen that amount of time from 6 months to 1 year to eliminate the number of cases that are going into what we know as suspense, and to also prevent law enforcement from having to retake fingerprints in situations where the juvenile disposition is not resolved by the six-month period.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. What percentage of the cases would this reduce then going into suspense or requiring law enforcement to take those actions?
Mr. Chair, as an example, from September of last year, at the six-month period, we still had 62% open arrests in the juvenile criminal history database. So this would be, we hope, a significant reduction in that suspense issue.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Do you have any idea what kind of significant reduction? Just ballpark, even?
Mr. Chair, I can try to find that out for you, but I don't have that information with me. Great.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Any other questions from members of the committee for Ms. Engler or the committee's author? Seeing none, then the chair renews his motion that House File 3381 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the House Committee on Public Safety Policy and Oversight. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say no. Motion passes. Thank you, members. There will not be a division meeting 1 week from today, just so you know that. If for some reason we were to have one, Patrick will be in touch with individuals. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that you're going to be getting a couple more bills, and so you may have to have a division meeting prior to Friday.
Great. Then we will be in touch with everyone about that, because Mom just told me I have to meet. But that being said, committee adjourned.